Dear listeners, welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. You've probably never heard of my guest today, but Mike Bisner might be the most well-connected person in our sport. He has covered every base at an executive level, as general manager of one of the largest specialty chains in the retail sector, as marketing director at Salomon when the French juggernaut was riding high, and he later played a similar role at Head as it was shouldering its way into the first rank of ski suppliers in this country. He currently is the point man for the leading supplier of radio frequency chip readers, the system that turns a piece of plastic into a season pass or a day pass at most of the ski areas in America. He is also a dear friend and one of the most likable souls you'll ever meet. Mike Bisner, welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Jackson, it's great to be here with you and your subscribers.
Thank you, Mike. I'd like to begin where you began your life as a skier. Where did you grow up skiing?
Jackson, I grew up in Troy, New York. And no matter what direction you went, north, south, east, or west, you found skiing. Right out our doorway off of Route 2, there was a Taconic Trails ski area that we skied at. I grew up skiing at a place called Willard Mountain. And when I really got my teeth into it was when one of my best friend's father decided to open a ski area because they had 10 children, and he thought it would be cheaper than buying season passes for all of them at Willard Mountain.
That's a great story. So what was your first ski industry job, however humble it may have been?
So this small little ski area called Rock Candy Mountain started as a Christmas tree farm in Melrose, New York, about 20 minutes outside of downtown Troy. And my best friend's father was an anesthesiologist with these 10 children, as I told you. And he bought this farm and decided to put a ski area in when we were 14 years old. And Kevin and I enlisted to help build the foundations for the Hall Tea Bar, put together the barn as a base lodge. And the incentive for us was we were 14 and we could get a farm driver's license at that time when the driving age was 16. So Kevin and I basically enlisted. Father sent us to New York City in a rack truck with farm plates from Melrose, New York, to pick up the rental fleet that he bought from Saks Fifth Avenue, which was Northland wooden ski, threw in edges, Gates A Top Star step-in state-of-the-art bindings, and Riker leather lace boots. So you imagine two 14-year-olds going down the New York State Thruway in a rack truck with farm plates and trying to locate the loading dock at Saks Fifth Avenue.
Probably at a max speed of like 50 miles an hour anyway. I remember that because the same was true in Vermont. If you had a farm license, you could drive at 14. Of course, I ignored all that. I didn't get my driver's license until after college, at the other end of the spectrum. Your experience in retail eventually would lead you to the top management job, second only to the owner, at a 20-plus location specialty chain ski market, which was a force to be reckoned with back in the day. What was the path you followed to the executive suite?
I started while in business school out at SUNY in Buffalo. At the time, Ski Market had three ski market stores, Boston, Latham, and Williamsville, New York. And I was mounting bindings and stringing tennis rackets at night while going to business school at SUNY. When I graduated, Bob Ferguson offered me the job as the manager of his specialty shop called St. Moritz Sports in downtown Wellesley. That was his first store that he built the ski market off of. He saw that skiing was expanding beyond the highbrow specialty offering of Head skis and Strolz boots, and basically opened up the first ski market store, I believe, in 1972. This was 1974 that I was working at the Buffalo Williamsville store. Chris Leake actually was the assistant manager there, and I lived with him for the first month of moving into my life as a student at in Buffalo, which, by the way, in 1974, that was a great time. OJ was running the football for the Bills, and they had the Buffalo Braves NBA franchise in Buffalo at the time with Bob McAdoo, and it was a great sports town to go to college in. Upon graduating, I went to St. Moritz to be the manager of that specialty shop. which at the time was probably doing about $1 million, which was huge back in the late 70s. I was manager there for 4 to 5 years before being elevated to the operations manager for the ski market stores. And that's when we really expanded to open 5 stores around the 128 Boston hub and expand into Connecticut with 3 stores also.
You had quite a cast of assistant managers yourself, people that went on to become, well, president of SIA, people that ran Vocal in this country, people that rose to a high level in Salomon. Let's throw a few names around just for the folks out there who want to say, hey, mom, I made the podcast.
Well, what was interesting at this St. Moritz Sports, and it really was sort of the backbone of the ski market organization. Bob had his office there. I actually operated under the close guidance of the mastermind behind ski market, Bob Ferguson. And my assistant manager at one point was Mike Noonan, who went on to be the president of Vocal, Marker, Del Bello. Ken McDonald, who worked with me at Salomon, and now I believe is still, he's the rep at Head for New England. And Tom Abrams was a salesman. Tom works for Superfeet and is a sales manager or something at Superfeet. There were probably 10 people that worked there in the late 70s, early 80s that all are still in the industry working at some capacity.
It sounds as though ski market's rise to prominence was fairly swift. Once Ferguson got his bit in his teeth, he ran to expand rather rapidly. Was there any real competition for you in that regard?
The ski market opened a store in Denver and got its butt kicked by Gart Brothers. And that's when Ferguson decided, let's shore up the Boston market and have multiple stores like Gart had in the Denver metro area. And that was the whole premise for expansion of ski market. And the sport was growing leaps and bounds back then, Jackson. As you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, skiing was not an elitist sport like it is now. It was an everyman sport. The ski market introduced the first SMUs, or private label skis. And he finally went to Rossignol and said, give me 2 SKUs, and I want like 5,000 of each pair. And Rossignol couldn't refuse that. And that was the creation of the SMU. I remember it was the Racer and the Racer 100. And I think they were the same exact skis. And one sold for $99 and the other one for $149.
Just for your edification, dear listeners, an SMU is a special makeup unit, and it would go on to dominate the bottom half of the sport. For example, you just alluded to the Denver market where you had Gartenly Garts, but Cooks. Well, Garts would want to ski and Cooks would want to ski. So you made a different top skin on exactly the same ski, and voila, Garts had a ski and Cooks had a ski. What you're saying is that Ski Market pioneered in this area by going to Rossignol and say, listen, rather than getting your shorts in the knot about upsetting your other dealers, just make us our own ski. Of course, they didn't actually make you your own ski. They made you your own top skin. And thereby, they were able to multiply the amount of skis they had in the marketplace by multiplying the amount of model names that they spread around that market. In addition to all of the brick and mortar locations, Ski Market also served as the sponsoring dealer at the New England Ski Show. How many skis and boots would you typically sell at that show? And can you tell us a little more background about how big that show was in the day?
So Bernie Weichel was the producer of the Boston Ski Travel Show. And in 1984, he actually gave us space to come in and retail goods. And we started out with a small footprint, maybe 25 to 100 or 5,000 square feet, not large. And we brought mostly beginner packages and children's stuff and some used stuff. And it was a huge success for us. It was around $250,000 in sales, which, as you know, some small specialty shops takes a year to do that. And we did that in 3 days in Boston. from there, the show grew every year. We moved the location to a location outside of Boston called Bayside Expo Center. And we took, in the end, we were taking almost 20,000 square feet of space and doing, you know, just under $2 million in sales. I don't have the number of units of skis that we sold, but in that heyday, the ski market in all locations were selling 40 to 50,000 pair of skis.
Whew, that's a very significant number, ladies and gentlemen. If that were in today's market, it would be literally 10% of the U.S. market. It wasn't 10% of the market then because we had many, many more units pumping through the U.S. market back in those days. The same was true of the show itself. They must have had many more attendees than they currently do. You know what their three-day population of visitors was?
My best recollection was somewhere between 40 and 50,000 people would go through the turnstiles. We expanded it to actually a Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday show. The busiest, obviously, you'd have different people. It would be date night on Thursday or Friday, and then the divorced dad with the three kids on Saturday morning traipsing through, getting all the stickers and posters, as well as picking up really last year's models or things that we actually bought in anticipation. Lots of closeouts at that time as things were expanding. I believe, you know, at that time, the market was around 2 million pair of skis in the U.S. or North America.
One of the smaller links that connect your past to mine is that ski market would become a Desperate Measures client. Desperate Measures was a sales training program created by myself and Dave Bertone that at least some locations adopted for their ski shops. Refresh my memory, had you already moved on from ski market by this time?
I had moved on. When I was there, we had an established training department with a hard goods trainer, a soft goods trainer, and a support person to produce all the manuals, the materials, and HR for the employees. I had left in the early 90s to go to Salomon. And at that time, there was lots of consolidation and elimination of that training department, which is when they outsourced it to you and Dave.
It was a great boon to us, although we were fighting market trends, which eventually proved more powerful than we were.
Training was a real key to have professional, educated, hard goods and soft goods people, and really not being pushy salespeople, but smart, educated ski enthusiasts on the floor. We really had so many overqualified people that were college graduates from, you know, Ivy Leagues all over the New England area wanting to live in Boston. So we would put them to work. And even after their first year at Ski Market, and they found one person, I remember, found a job as an editor at the Atlantic, and she continued to work Ski Market in Boston at night so that she could get a pro deal and free skiing all the benefits of a ski market employee, which were many in the New England area.
Before we move on to the next stage of your career, I want to give a shout out in particular to Chris Leek, who I knew better back in the day than I knew you during your ski market period. Do you still see the man we know as Leaker from time to time?
Chris and I remain great friends. As a matter of fact, I probably have at least 50 great friends from the ski market days. When I was at Ski Market, we rented a house at Sugarbush for the employees to use on their days off. And it was quite a bit of bonding. And thank God there were no cell phones and cameras back in those days, for sure. But Chris is one of the people that he bought a house at Sugarbush because of it. He's fitting boots up there now for Joe Podolak at Alpine Options. And I see him on the slopes all the time, and we get to take some great runs together and try to plan different ski trips together. His wife and my wife are good friends. And yeah, the ski market community, what's interesting, I met my wife at the St. Moritz Sports in Wellesley, where she was a Wellesley College student that could add, when you have four or five cash registers running and a dyslexic assistant manager, you needed a smart Wellesley girl to cash out at night.
You did very, very well in that department, my dear friend. Now, Like a lot of other specialty retail chains around the country, like Sport Chalet, Sunset Sports, Wolf's, Bavarian Village, just to name a few, Ski Market would go from riding high to a nosedive into oblivion. What caused this once vital sector of the ski retail community to crater? What caused such a seismic shift? In other words, what did Ski Market et al. Die of?
Jackson, I think Ski Market and the other, I'm going to call them suburban shops that you mentioned, like Bavarian Village, and just failed to change with technology. The internet came out. There was lots of information. There was also a reduction and downturn in the sport. I don't think that any of these retailers stepped up to the technology change required for multi-channel marketing, as opposed to just selling from the brick and mortar. They really needed to be a multi-channel marketer and have offerings and bring the person in off the internet to the store. What's interesting now is retail's had this resurgence because of COVID and requiring an appointment to come in and get a boot fit. So you can't basically go in and just try on a boot and then go order it off the internet. The person knows they need to be fit properly. They can't just go buy a boot sight unseen without putting it on their foot. So COVID really brought back specialty retail pretty much at the mountain locations, and a couple strong suburban guys still survive. But for the most part, it was a shift in technology as well as a downturn in the sport.
Now, if I have my chronology correct, you went from Ski Market, owned by Bob Ferguson, as you just mentioned, to Salomon North America, which was then presided over by another Bob, Bob Soden. I recall an anecdote from this period that goes something like this. When you were asked how your experience at Ski Market prepared you for the responsibilities you had at Salomon, you replied with your typically insouciant wit, "I learned to say, yes, Bob," which I think is concise and utterly brilliant. So how did your time at Ski Market inform your job at Salomon?
So it was interesting that I made that comment at a lunch with Bob Soden, which was about my fourth or fifth interview with him and other members of the Salomon team. And basically, that is exactly how it went. Later, he tells me that there were over 300 applicants for the director of marketing at Salomon at the time. He says, "What I really liked about you, Mike, is you weren't trying to bullshit me or tell me how we should be doing things." He says, "I thought that your retail experience and being able to deliver the message to our marketing agency as well as our sales team would be helpful." And there were a bunch of different shifts at that time where we took a lot of the marketing money and moved it to focus on the retail salesperson. We created a thing called the Spring Fling, which at the end of the year, Crested Butte was offering free skiing after April 1st. So we decided to have a party out at Crested Butte and invite all of our dealers and their employees to come ski for free at Crested Butte. And all we did is buy the beer and bring bands and all of our sponsored athletes to ski with them, like Scott Schmidt and the Delorier brothers and the Egan brothers, and as well, just everybody, because as you know, that genre at the time was all basically celebrities created off of VHS film releases.
At one time, Salomon was regarded as the most consistently innovative brand in the ski market. What major moves occurred at Salomon while you were there?
So we were in a huge, expansion. We introduced the X hiking shoe and hiking boots.
By the way, ladies and gentlemen, that has become, in my opinion, the single most successful diversification by any single ski brand into something else not called skiing. And every other brand in the ski industry, make no mistake about it, suffers from a severe case of Salomon envy as a result, because they wish that they had bled the hundreds of thousands of dollars that it took to establish this footwear brand back in the day. But there was more than just the hiking shoe. I pardon my interruption, but that was so significant.
So the French, as you know, Jackson, having worked with them, they were big into doing research. Bob Soden was smart enough to say, "Guys, there's no sense in continuing our 3-year research, whether we should get into snowboarding. There's this guy, Brad Stewart, that's got a small clothing company called Bonfire. Let's hire him since he knows the culture of snowboard, and we created the snowboard division of Salomon when I was there. We also entered the inline skate market and hired an expert from one of the inline skate manufacturers, okay, to head up sales and marketing for that. So we were on a tear of expansion. We launched the Snowblade, which was a short-lived phenomenon. The biggest thing we missed, and as you know, the arrogance sometimes, there was the product manager was a guy named Al Marino at the time. And Al and I were screaming along with all of the salesmen that there's this new shaped ski thing going on over at Elan called an SCX, and we needed a shaped ski. And the French assured us that it was the year of the binding and that they were introducing the ProPulse and the spheric binding. And don't worry that that would drown out this whole shape ski thing, which, of course, you know, was a bad move on Salomon's part at that time.
It was probably the single biggest whiff, in fact, that Salomon had in a 30-year period of almost unrelenting success. I remember, just to pick another aspect of that time, because I want my dear listeners to understand how different this era was from what we live in today. During your tenure at Salomon, I remember at one point you had a two-story booth at the SIA show, the cost of which I can barely imagine. But the SIA show mattered a great deal then, and it was convened in Las Vegas, which was a big deal as well, because that was a great place not just to do business, but to party, which we did not overlook. So it was great business and great fun, which have never returned to SIA. What killed the SIA show?
Well, let me go back to the booth, Jackson. The reason it was a story booth is the French had created the ProLink, which, you know, was this anti-vibration arm on the ski, and they produced a 3D video that they wanted to release to our dealers and show, and it had to be a 3D theater with the 3D glasses at the time. So I had to construct a booth to have a theater in it, which basically, why, if we're going to have an enclosure, let's put some stairs and have meeting rooms and booths on top there. And it was great because Bob Soden, the president at the time, could look down at Jacques Rodet at Rossignol and say, "Ha, I'm up on the second story and you only have a one-story booth."
That it may sound petty, ladies and gentlemen, but Rossignol always measured themselves by Salomon and vice versa. They were at each other's throats nonstop.
It was the heyday for sure, and I figured out a way to amortize that booth over a three-year period, so it fit into the budget of what our trade show booths were by amortization and actually then renting a storage facility for it in Las Vegas.
So SIA goes from this extravaganza where, in fact, at one time it was a six-day show, and that was pretty much in excess by anybody's measure, gradually dwindling to 5 and 4 days. Part of that dwindling was Eastern dealer attendance that didn't really see the point of flying all the way across the country for 4 or 5 or 6 days. Was declining dealer attendance a major factor, or were there some other things in play that were more significant in why trade shows drifted away?
So, Jackson, at that time, I was on the SIA trade show committee. I would say it was an internal implosion. You had three camps. You had the soft good manufacturers, the hard good manufacturers, and the accessory manufacturers. And all of them had different timelines and goals for taking orders and placing orders and samples arriving on time. It was an internal fight over the date. The soft goods people wanted the date actually in November, the hard goods people, because of sampling and getting everything in place, needed it in late February, early March. And then the accessory guys could care less. The later the better, because the open to buy that a retailer had, the later it was, the better their sell through numbers would be for the year. So those accessory manufacturers all wanted it even later. So it was really a conflict as to the dates. And then bouncing around and moving the dates, I think, really confused the hell out of all the retailers, whether they were from the East or the West. And eventually, you had competing shows. You had the buying groups, creating their own buying group show, which took an awful lot of the pre-booking of hard goods away from the need for SIA. So it sort of fragmented is the best way to say, with the different needs of the different suppliers.
Now, if you were just to look at attendance, if you will, the soft goods suppliers have won, because SIA, which is now a subset of OR, a very small subset of OR, is going to convene in late November, but it's too late. The party has moved on. Soft goods people have found another way to get their orders booked without going to any show at all and meeting the urgency of their needs to get their orders into China or Indonesia or Vietnam or wherever they're going now to make their stuff. So when SIA sold itself to Emerald Exhibitions, it was basically finishing off an opera that it was already over.
Yeah, I think it was a pretty smart move to actually take a dying show and hand it off as something more than it was. I think they got something like $16 million from Emerald Exhibitions, who I believe is a publicly traded company whose stock has plummeted significantly since their heyday, with the outdoor retailer show being one of the largest ones and successful. And again, now they've moved it from Salt Lake to Denver, and I think they're going back to Salt Lake, if I'm not mistaken. So right. It confuses the retailer and it loses the audience.
What was your fondest memory of your time at Salomon, a brand, dear listeners, that I too once worked for? You had a pretty handsome budget when you were there, did you not?
I did. The A&P budget was always around 5% of the gross. We went from $75 million to almost $140 million in sales while I was there. It was a heyday of the Force 9 and the Extreme. And back in that day, actually, we had, while the shape ski phenomenon was going on and everybody got all the attention, we launched what I would say is probably the only 15, 20-year-old ski that you could go out and ski on today, which was the X Mountain. If you remember that.
I do.
Yellowish ski, kind of a really almost a terrible graphic, but it was 75 millimeters at the waist.
That, which, ladies and gentlemen, why a wide 75 millimeters at the waist? Something we would now consider to be a frontside carving ski dimension. At that time was like, holy shnikes, 75.
And it was skied so well in so many conditions. What was really funny is Al Marino, as I mentioned before, the product manager, and I were to take the Salomon answer to the shape called an Exendo, which was an absolutely awful ski, and this Cross Mountain. And we went up, we were having a sales meeting in Denver, and the two of us were told to go up and test these two against each other and then come back before we forecast the quantities from for production. Al is probably 10 years younger than I am, and he started out on this Exendo. I started out on the X Mountain, and we had 2 to 3 feet of fresh snow, a copper. And we come down, and I'm just giddy and happy, and he's sweating and miserable. And after 3 or 4, he's on the lift, kind of, he's got to get in shape, and his wife's pregnant, and he's got to really stop eating out and all this. So we switch skis, and all of a sudden, I'm sweating, and he is like having a great time. He had a big smile at the end of the day. He goes, well, I'm glad it's just not me. and we went back and forecasted the quantities on each of those skis. It was a huge success. We had a lot of successful models then, but that whole genre of experimentation with widths and shapes and stuff was going on at that time. And Salomon was still focused on the binding war between, it was them or Marker, if you remember. Each one of them had 45% market share. The 10% was divided between Tyrolia and Look and Scraps. It's totally changed now.
Yes, it has. I may be off on my sequence of events, but I believe it was after Salomon that you took on a similar role at Nordica. Did they woo you away from Salomon? What was that transition like?
Salomon was purchased by Adidas, and they were moving the location from Georgetown, Mass. Out to Portland, Oregon, where Adidas was. I stayed in Boston and opted not to go. My wife was, as an investment banker, was bringing home a lot more than I was in the ski industry. So we stayed in Boston. And I actually had to sign a non-compete for a year. And about 9 months into it, I got a call from Bill Lawless, who was the number two person at the Prince Sports Group in charge of sales and marketing for the Western Hemisphere, and said, "Hey, Benetton just bought Nordica, and we'd like you to interview to be the winter sports brand manager for the Benetton sports system."
So, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, if you remember that era, a cold shiver will go down your spine at the name of Benetton, easily the worst custodian of Alpine ski brands that has ever crossed paths. And they would end up losing a small fortune that they made by selling cotton sweaters for a lot of money by their little adventure in skiing. Your tenure at Prince didn't quite turn out the way you thought it was going to go. Tell me a little about that.
I was hired to, again, be the brand manager for winter sports, which their biggest marquee was Nordica Ski Boots at the time. They had Kessley skis, which were a third tier distribution at that point in time as far as numbers, and Killer Loop snowboards and Nordica apparel. Nordica was based out of Essex Junction, Vermont. And I said to Kerry, "Oh, great, we can move to Vermont. We can have that second house, the ski house in Vermont. We'll go up there." About 6 weeks into commuting to Essex Junction, or Williston, Vermont, I get a call to come down to Bordentown, New Jersey, to the headquarters for Prince Sports Group, and was told that I was going to close that facility, lay off 90 of the 95 employees, and bring five of the people that I thought were qualified down to teach all of the Prince supporting group. It was hard to convince anybody to move from Vermont to Bordentown, New Jersey. So we all got apartments down there and commuted. And as you know, I hired Scott Mellon, who was the product manager at DNR, was it? Snowboard division of Marker, and he and his wife sold their house out in Salt Lake City and moved to New Jersey with me. He became the product manager with us.
I actually gave him your name. I don't know if you know that at the time, but he was very unhappy because Hank Tauber, the founder and longtime manager of the Marker brand worldwide, had created at considerable expense a snowboard factory to make snowboards for a number of brands that then didn't want their snowboards made suddenly by them. And he was pulling the rug out from under a lot of their activities. At any rate, he was unhappy. And I said, "You know, my friend Biz is going to need someone, some kind of help over at Nordica." So anyway, just little detail background, how these things sometimes transpire.
It was a wild time, Jackson, working for the Italians. Go to 10,000 feet on this. They were Nike envious. Here they were making fashion apparel, and Nike is selling more sports apparel. So they thought the way to get into sports apparel was to acquire all these brands. So they acquired Prince and Ectalon in the racket arena, expanded the Prince name into golf and shoes also. Then they acquired Nordica. When Scott and I were there, we were looking at, we're selling about 75,000 pair of Nordica boots and 6,000 pair of Kessley skis. They were giving us no money to advertise and promote Kessley. So we basically convinced them to let's continue to make the same skis and put Nordica on them rather than Kessley, and shelve the Kessley brand, put Nordica on the skis. And if I remember correctly, we went from selling 6,000 Kessleys to selling 27,000 pair of Nordicas in the first year. And it was the same ski with the Nordica branding on it. As you know, it's now one of the lead brands out there. So it was a good move at the time, but it was a wild learning experience where you're constantly consolidating and bringing in Rollerblade and firing this group and consolidating sales forces. It was an MBA at that time.
As I mentioned a few moments ago, Benetton did not do any of the brands that they acquired any favors. Kessley went through a particularly dark period. They made some skis with hollow cores that they called ecothesis and thinthesis, and they resided happily at the very bottom of the snow country ski test results.
You speak of the fiber tube?
Yes. Unbelievably bad skis, and it was capped off by something called the B-52, probably the most comically bad ski ever made. You know the nose strips that are made to supposed to give you better inhalation or whatever? That was their side cut. Big spatula in the front, narrow little waist, which abruptly went to a narrow little waist, and then a big spatula in the back. Unskiable is too kind a word for that ski. So you were not fishing with good bait at that particular time. What held Nordica together then was you had a field force which averaged about 20 years of experience in the field. Speak to the value of a brand having a great field force.
All great sales guys, both on the hard goods and the soft goods side of things, that had relationships with the dealers. And I remember at one SIA in March, we were told, do not let anyone put the boots on, our flagship, the Echo Skeleton boot, because it was the wrong last, it didn't fit. And we had to convince dealers to order this for next year without ever putting it on their foot. And there was, of course, pushback on that. And we promised them we would have a fitting boot in May. And we invited 175 dealers of our biggest dealers to a wonderful boondoggle out at Whistler on the Canadian Memorial Day weekend, which is the weekend before our Memorial Day. And we flew in Schuss and Amat, who are our two pinnacle athletes at the time. And we skied the glacier in the morning and played golf in the afternoon. I think you were part of the press corps on that boondoggle.
I did make the press corps on that boondoggle. Thank you so much for the invitation. I milked it as hard as I could. I remember we were skiing on the glacier in the morning. You had contrived some sort of a shape ski slalom course to try to maximize the sort of style then popular for trying to maximize the effect of the side cut and a turn. And then we went and played golf, where we were visited by some very large four-footed friends. The bears roamed freely on the course, and nobody messed with the bears on the golf course.
Oh, that was a riot. I can remember you telling me, give them the hot dog. Throw them the hot dog. Let's get out of here.
So after Nordica, which you survived, you went on, I believe, to Head. I had been at Head not too long before you, so I worked with a similar cast. Klaus Hotter ran the ski division. Alberto Cenedesi had come over from Nordica to work at Brixia, where they made the San Marco and the Head boots. And Tirolia, which was run by a formidable tyrant named Edgar Pullman. But the owner, Johan Elias, was the one who really ran the show and called all the shots and ran what I characterize as sort of a Chinese warlord system of management, because everyone was given their own portfolio and then they had to fight for the dollars for each of their different sectors in order to prevail, whether it was in tennis or in ski or somewhere else. But you moved over then to Head. Talk about what it was like to making another major transition from one major brand to another.
Well, having worked for the French and the Italians prepared me to work for the Austrians, who actually culturally march in a much straighter line than the Italians or the French, who would rather do studies on something rather than actually produce it and launch it after X number of years. So I enjoyed working for the Austrian team. What was interesting is it was a revolving leadership for the president of that winter sports division, Carl Helmetag, then Bob Soden. And then when Robert Langlois came in, Robert is someone I had worked with at Salomon also. Robert was the president of Salomon Canada when I was at Salomon USA. He gave me a call and said, hey, would you consider moving down here to Norwalk, Connecticut, and heading up the marketing department? I think we got a pretty good team. We actually had pretty much all of the old Salomon guys in place for sales. Mike Poole, who had worked with us at Salomon, was the sales manager, and Brad White out in the Midwest, Ken Griffin, a lot of familiar Salomon names were all now at Head. And we actually had a pretty good strategy where we were launching this BYS system, which was a rental system that had prefixed bindings and only three lengths of boots. So instead of changing the binding setting and on a track and having 2,500 different settings between the tension on the binding and the length of the sole, eliminated all of this so you could preset the tensions with the sole lengths and speed up the bottleneck at rental shops at resorts. And this was a huge push at that particular time. And we also did a top-down strategy, signing Bodie Miller and Ted Ligety and Julia Mancuso to the race team and really supporting the brand at the high end at the retail and introducing it to the resorts in large fleets. I mean, our fleet business at that time was, you know, $5, $6 million a year of revenue, selling it to the Intrawests and the large resort conglomerates at that time. So it worked out great. The time at Head was a lot of fun with the same old friends that I had made several years before at Salomon.
You had a few more tools in your toolbox when you were at Head than I did. I had come in before you, and we had Bupkis in the U.S. We didn't have a single U.S. Bodie Miller, are you kidding? We didn't have anybody, male or female. I had one parallel mogul skiing woman on the U.S. ski team. That was as close as I got to having any of that. But I did create a freestyle team, and I think a lot of that did continue on. I didn't sign Yoon Olsen, but I did sign Johnny Mosley and signed a bunch of other people whose names might be familiar, like Darian Boyle and Aaron Estrada and Rex Werman. Nonetheless, it was a struggle to try to plant Head's flag anywhere west of the Monongahela Valley or whatever it's called. We had a small number of fans in the east and zero penetration in free skiing. But before I left, we put together a ski called the Monster. And that year at Crested Butte, we won the men's, women's, and junior freestyle award at the competition at Crested Butte. And that, I think, was in March or April. And by June, on my wife's 50th birthday, I was fired. There ended my tenure rather dramatically. But you, I think, had a better ride than Head. But what was your exit from Head?
At that time, we had a finance director. He was an Austrian based out of Greenwich, who was there because his kids went to the international school in Greenwich. He was being pulled back to Austria, and they decided to close that expensive real estate office in Norwalk and move it to Boulder. And at that time, both my boss, Robert Langlois, and myself were told they're moving the office to Boulder, and they were hiring a young guy who's now the president to do both our jobs. And that was John Rucker, who's done a fabulous job with Head. And in the move to Boulder, it's far culturally where it should be, as opposed to exit 16 off of I-95 in Norwalk, Connecticut, where we were headquartered simply because they had bought a dive business called Decor and combined that with Mares, which they also owned. If you remember, it was HTM Sports, which is Head Tyrolia and Mares, the dive equipment supplier.
I just wanted to add one other point. I couldn't agree with you more about the stewardship of John Rucker. He has done a masterful job of running the Head brand in the U.S. market. And I tip my hat to Mr. Rucker in passing here. So after Head, you became the VP of Business Development for MWRC, which you can explain what that stands for. It was a vehicle for compensating retailers for sales made by suppliers via the internet. Does that make sense? Do I have that right?
So, Jackson, I was approached while I was at Head by this group, which is manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, and consumers. The software was created by the family that owned Body Glove. Body Glove is an interesting brand in that they manufactured nothing. Everything was licenses. They licensed the wetsuit to one company, the bathing suits to another company. They were basically a licensing company. And they saw the web as the way to bring all these products with 90 different partners and licenses out selling sunscreen, underbody glove, or wetsuits, or surfboards, or paddleboards, et cetera, under one brand. But they didn't want to put the retailer out of business. It was a very ahead of its time technology where the brand would communicate with the consumer would buy from the brand. The brand would then ask the consumer, would you like to pick it up at this? Or you give them a list of their local retailers. They'd pick one, and that retailer would get credit for the sale. If they wanted to ship to their house, the retailer would get less of a credit towards that sale if they were not engaging with the consumer. But it was very sophisticated technology that I thought and saw through my retail eyes, my branding manufacturer's eyes, as the future. They're still in business. Leckie uses them. If you order anything from Leckie on a pro form, or they execute the Leckie website. I don't know what other manufacturers that I had signed at the time that are still with them. But there's several competing companies. One is called Locally, I believe, or Shop right. Locally.
Locally.com.
Yeah. That was my, I'm going to say, switch to what technology is next. And that's what really brought me to RFID, is what I could see as a future that was going to actually make the customer experience a better, easier transition and help grow the sport.
I want to get into your RFID activity now because it's what you're doing and it's top of mind. But I wanted to just add one other point. Now, every brand, without exception, sells direct to the consumer. And several brands have already told their dealer network, more or less, no soup for you. In other words, if we manage to sell it, we're not going to give you a cut. We're not going to give you a percentage. We're going to give you a pat on the back saying, love you guys, you're great, but this sale came to us. So we are going to take the considerably larger margin we get by selling direct, and you can go back to selling whatever else you want at your little retail store. So that certainly has weakened the field that brands like MWRC can operate in.
I think that the top brands like a Nike that have the customer's share of mind already can do that. But I think it's a slippery slope, especially with specialty brands like a Patagonia or a boot manufacturer or a ski manufacturer to sell direct to the customer and cut out the retailer. I think it's pretty short-sighted.
Let's now go on to your current baby. First of all, what does RFID stand for? How did it get started? And what fueled its phenomenal growth?
So RFID is radio frequency ID, identification. And it is in all of our lives. It's been in all of our lives for 30 years. If you have a cat or a dog, your cat or dog have an RFID chip in it. So they are leading the technology in the household of being chipped with a RFID tag that can identify them when they get lost and they go to a veterinarian, and the vet has the tool to read that tag number, which is associated with the owner who registered the pet initially. The way it started in skiing, in Europe, most of the large ski complexes are owned by multiple people. Our biggest customer is Super Ski Dolomiti, which are 14 different ski areas surrounding the Sella Ronda. Many are famous, the Cortina, Val Gardena, Alta Badea, and there's some not so famous smaller ones around this UNESCO site in northeastern Italy. I think it's close to 140 different shareholders. If your family farmed this one land and your cattle graze there, and it happens to connect one valley to the next valley, you put up a Doppelmayr lift maybe 20 years ago. By connecting one valley to the next, it created this entire ski complex where Super Ski, I believe, has 400 lifts under one lift ticket. These 400 lifts have 1,850 of our gates. And when you ride that lift, you buy the pass for the week and you ride each lift, each owner gets a share of your ticket based on what lift you happen to ride in your week stay.
The Dolomiti is not the only place in which this parceling out of who gets a nickel. And that's just as you say, if some farmer put up a lift in his backyard, but you ride his lift, it goes a little ka-ching.
All the major complexes. The Aalborg region is probably our second largest over there. And there's complexes in France and Spain and Andorra. Make it very easy for the consumer to go on a vacation and not have to pull out their credit card on every different lift that they ride. And that was the, I'm going to say, the birth of the reason for introducing RFID. Here, it is actually much different in that your ski area is owned by the individual one company. But what's happened is when I started selling this now, going back 13 years, it was all about making sure everybody had a lift ticket and they couldn't get through the gate unless they had a lift ticket. And it was anti-fraud. That still exists today, but it's nowhere near as important as the data that the ski area captures. They know how many lift rides you've taken for the day, how many hours on their resort, what their lift utilization is for the day based on the crowds. They can traffic pattern the movement of people through RFID.
They can tell what you had for lunch, right?
If you pay with your RFID card, which is your resort charging, yes. They know how much you spend. They can measure the value of each consumer and tier them to send out through their CRM different marketing messages for a top-tier spender versus a middle-tier spender versus someone that they want to encourage to spend more. It is about the data, for sure. During COVID, when it was anti-touch and no lines and spacing, our business grew 75% in year one, 50% in year two. And it was all about touchless, contactless purchasing of a lift ticket online, going to a kiosk with your phone, presenting your phone under the kiosk and having it print your RFID ticket out of our pub. We called it a pickup box. I think we have over 1,500 of them around the country now. Many even small resorts like Blue Mountain, Pennsylvania have 14 of them. During COVID, they were selling 98% of their tickets online in advance.
Dear listeners, I would be derelict in my duties if I didn't mention that Biz is not only a ski industry legend, but he is a genuine real skier as well. I've bumped into you more than once on the slopes of Snowbird, where you've had a long-standing 2 weeks a season reserved at the Iron Blossom, I believe. Tell us about your time at Snowbird and your favorite runs, you know, the relationship between you and that mountain.
Jackson, Snowbird and the Alta Snowbird Complex, in my opinion, is the best skiing in the U.S. by far. I never get tired of it. In 1977, the spring of 77, while I was just starting at Ski Market, I went to a timeshare presentation and bought my first unit for $2,800. The closing line was great. The salesman said, "Do you think you could ski Snowbird 1 week a year for the rest of your life?" Sold. Okay. And I had no money and put the $500 deposit on a credit card and got a coupon book. The kicker was they gave you 100 free lift tickets, good for the first 5 years. And basically would bring all my friends out. I think the two Noonan brothers have slept on the floor. We in a one-bedroom hotel room with an attached studio kitchen. I think we had 14 people on an annual basis out there in the early years. But we did save enough to go heli skiing at least one day with the Powder Birds. So yeah, it's a great spot. Favorites, when it's snowing, I stay on the GAD 2 chair. The skiing under the GAD 2 chair and STH and in those trees is the best skiing that you can find on a powder day and not fighting the tram line and just lapping up there. That's my favorite.
My best run of the year last year, without question, was under GAD 2. And I found a little column of trees. It was like a tiny little chapel. And there were bumps under there, but they were under about 4 feet of snow. And it was like, suddenly the skies opened up and a chorus of angels were singing and you had your own little paradise. It may have only been 20 turns, but they were 20 perfect turns. It was, I think it's a most magical place you can ski. As you know, I don't just think it's a ski area. I think it's a spiritual center that if you open your heart and your mind to the possibilities, it doesn't just make you a better skier, it can make you a more self-aware human being.
This year, I do have 2 weeks of timeshare there now. And this year, my time is week 14 and 15 in April, and I had to be in Austria for Interalpen, which is a large trade show to the resorts over there, and Access has a huge booth. They needed my presence there. So I couldn't go, and I let a customer of mine, Carolyn Stimson, who owns Wachusett, use the unit with her son, and they went out there, and this is a great comment about the Iron Blossom Lodge. She says, I went into the hot tub and it looked like a scene out of Cocoon. She goes, how many old farts are out there on your week? I said, no one is sold. They're all still coming back. And as long as their knees can still move, they're out there all day long. And that hot tub, as you know, is well needed after a day on the slopes at Snowbird.
Switching gears, I believe among the many ways that you give back to the sport is that you serve on the board of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame. My question to you is a rather pointed one, but I hope you embrace it. Is there any sentiment for moving the hall from Ishpeming, Michigan to anywhere else but Ishpeming, Michigan?
So, Jackson, do you know why it's in Ishpeming?
Yeah, John Fry, as you know, a man that I absolutely revered and treasured every moment I got to work with him at Snow Country Magazine, explained it to me. It was the foundational location for ski jumping and therefore for skiing of any kind on the North American continent, if I'm not mistaken. But please correct me if I'm wrong.
You're correct. And the reason it was created there is the first charter for competitive skiing was created, I think, in 1904, 1906 there for ski jumping, because ski racing didn't exist yet. It's my understanding that the ski team still operates under that charter for international ski competition. So that's why the museum ended up there. The local community has a lot of strong support for it, because there is not a lot going on up there other than having the museum in the upper UP. I think that smartly, one of our past chairmen, Bernie Weichel, said we need to bring some notoriety or recognition to this organization outside of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and started hosting the event to induction event at a major ski area. We started this probably, I think, maybe 15 years ago. And now a lot of the areas are actually competing to host this event, where the inductees are brought in with their families. Basically, the induction ceremony takes place at a destination resort. Last year, it was in Big Sky. This year, it's in Park City. And this has saved the organization, I'm going to say temporarily. We're talking about a moving exhibition or multiple moving exhibitions, putting it possibly in airports like the new Salt Lake Airport that's expanded. And we need to get the message far beyond the Ishpeming location. But I think that the local support there, as well as Ski Michigan and the Ski Michigan people, are very proud of this. And it's too big a building to move, quite honestly, right now. So it's in our conversation each time as to how we can expand the organization and bring more recognition to the history of skiing and the people that actually built this industry, whether they're an athlete, a industry builder, or a real legend. It's amazing when you read some of the biographies of what these people have done. We have over 400 inductees currently. You, as a ski enthusiast, would recognize 350 of the 400, for sure.
Well, actually, I'm on the nominating committee, I think it's considered, and I vote on people getting in or out. And I'm actually just a huge fan, and I just don't want to see it become sort of an isolated adjunct to the sport, but more closely integrated with it, as it has been in the lives of all the people that are commemorated there. And speaking of lives that are commemorated, before we conclude, I just want to give a shout out to you, as I mentioned in the introduction, probably the greatest networker I've ever known, because not only did you make friends 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, they're still your friends. You still know them all. you still communicate with them all. I barely communicate with my family. You communicate with a coterie, I would say, of 500 people or so that have touched your life and remain part of your life. I think that's one of the most amazing things about you, Biz. I think it's a real honor to know you because I get to be one of the guys that Biz knows.
Well, Jackson, I can tell you the best thing about my career in this industry is the people that I have met, that I've become friends with, that I get to ski with, enjoy a beer with, and continue to share the same passion for the sport. I have a nephew who recently graduated from Champlain College. I was encouraging him to get into the ski industry. And he said, well, what's so different about it? I said, you know, Matty, we have a very low asshole quotient. There's very few assholes in this industry. I would say that in most businesses, you probably got a 50-50 chance of meeting assholes. And in the ski industry, I would say it's like 97% good people and only 3% are assholes. And they generally wash out, okay, because they're not accepted. It's all about the people. Now, twilight of my career, I'm really having a great time working with young, smart people, a lot smarter than me on the technology side. I'm just a sales guy that has contacts with decision makers at the resorts. In many cases, the same people that I sold a fleet of BYS skis to 15 years ago.
Well, Biz, it's been a pleasure sharing your rich history with our sport. Thank you so much for being a guest on Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. And dear listeners, thank you for spending your precious time with me on Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Biz, farewell until we meet again.
My pleasure. And let's catch a tram in April or before.
It's a date. And the Dolomiti. I don't want to miss the chance to ski the Dolomiti with
you. You haven't been there?
Never.
Oh, so we fly to Venice, a night or two in Venice in Carnival. That's the best time to be in Venice. Opening of Carnival, and then go up to the Dolomites.
I can't wait. Again, ladies and gentlemen, Mike Bisner. Thanks for listening.